The theme for the talk tonight is on recognizing true nature. I'd like to begin this talk with a quote from Albert Einstein. It's one that some of you, and maybe many of you, know, but it's a very important quote, I feel, relative to the Dharma and realization of the Dharma in our lives. And it goes like this. A human being is part of the whole called by us universe. A part that appears limited in time and space. He, she experiences him or herself, the thoughts, feelings, as something separate from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. Now, in reflecting on that teaching, that quote, does it not seem obvious that this is a teaching or quote based on contemplation of the facts? Both the relative facts, and here we're speaking of this kind of potential delusion that humans can be living in and through, but also something greater than this relative fact. Maybe you could even call it the absolute, if you would like. The absolute possibility of compassion and an awareness of complete interconnectedness, liberation from delusion. This is a contemplative statement. What we're here for is the practice which allows the manifestation of clear insight. We're here in this world, you could say very simply, to manifest. In fact, this body-mind process is a manifestation. So what's going to happen with it? What's going to be done with it? What's going to occur here? And if you look at you could say the scope and the breadth of what human beings have been engaged in, as far back as we know, there's a multiplicity of manifestations. You might say a multiplicity of possibilities, a multiplicity of experiences. So what is Albert pointing to? He's pointing to the possibility of the manifestation of not only clarity that sees this, as he called it, optical delusion of consciousness, but to see what's possible beyond that. And as I suggested before dinner, what is beyond, we often think of beyond as past, what is beyond is also prior to. Prior to the optical delusion of consciousness that has the human being preoccupied, predisposed, habituated in a limited sphere of experience that they call their own. Or, as he pointed out, affection for those nearest or dearest to one. that this can be seen. The actual manifestation of it can be seen. And how it manifests. Not just that it manifests, how it manifests. Because delusion has a cause. What is the cause of delusion? What is the cause of the prison of delusion? And the answer is very clear. Not just to our intellects, but experientially, through the gift of the practice. So if we look closely, we can see that delusion is born from ignoring, from ignorance. Not because we're stupid, although we could be, but because we're not seeing things clearly. This is what vipassana means, to see things clearly. The word vipassana, Buddhist Pali word, translated as insight, sometimes it's translated as mindfulness. That's not a very accurate translation, truly. In fact, it's quite difficult to truly translate the word vipassana into English, just like it's difficult to translate the word dukkha, which is the Buddhist Pali word for unsatisfactoriness, unreliability. That often gets translated as suffering. Something sometimes gets lost in translation. That's not just a Bill Murray movie. Lost in translation. So when we're looking at the nature of the so-called prison, we can begin to see its causes. We are naturally contemplative. You don't have to just be sitting in the dining hall, having had a nice meal, body satisfied, to be naturally contemplative. We're endowed with natural contemplativeness. It's, you might say, in our bone marrow, it's in our bloodstream. That can get colored, that can get diluted, that can get obstructed. And we begin to be preoccupied for moments or longer, and we're no longer contemplative. I actually interact with people sometimes in a therapeutic setting who have a conscious addiction to their cell phone, and usually that cell phone is got all kinds of different things that it can do, not just the old standard one-way phone like I still have, but the ones that have all these different applications. And I'll interact with people sometimes and they can hardly put the thing down. It's like it's got a cord, invisible cord, and the fellow is struggling to figure out how to not be focusing on this so much, because on the other end of this is all kinds of other things that he's connected to, that he's attached to. So he has a hard time putting it down, and he's proud of himself when he's able to put it down and for a few moments or minutes forget about it. Of course, then he's going to pick it up and there's going to be all kinds of stuff on there that happened when he wasn't paying attention. You've got to catch up now. Having said that, since a number of you are in the so-called back row, which is the place to be when you want a chair here if you don't have one in the hall, catch the back row. The Dharma talk possibility is like going to the movies. And the possibility here in terms of going to the movies, you might have contemplated this. Why are movies, why is Hollywood so popular to so many people? Lots of different reasons. But one of the reasons is because if the movie's a good movie, if it's an engaging movie, you forget about yourself. You experience anatta, that's the Buddhist Pali word for no self. Only thing is, you don't know that that happened, you see, because you were busy being in the movie, watching the movie, living through the character. living through the producer, living through the director, living through the script. People love to forget themselves. They love to forget themselves so much that they'll tie a big giant elastic band around their ankles and jump off a cliff to have a release from the norm. I mean, that's an interesting one, isn't it? Meow, boing. And some people, I know one in particular, he had to do that. It was an obsession. I gotta do it. And he went to this big giant cliff in New Zealand. And then, woo, off he went. Boing. And up he came. And now he did it. So anyways, going to the movies, okay, there's going to be certain things that will be said in this talk that in one or two short sentences is the whole talk. I'm not sure where that's going to be for you. I'm not even sure it's going to be for you. It's like people who put out a movie and they're really hoping that everybody's going to like it and it's a dud. Or they didn't know it was going to be good and all of a sudden it's this big hit. We're naturally contemplative, which means if you're sitting here trying to understand with your intellect what this talk could be pointing at, you're going to stay at a certain level of experience, which means you might understand it with your intellect. Oh yeah, that makes sense. Okay. When you're deep in the movie, your intellect actually can get quite quiet. In fact, it can even sort of just dissolve. And if you don't know this for sure, just take a look at somebody next to you who's completely absorbed in the movie. The mouth can be hanging open, the eyes can be like this, they could almost be drooling, they don't know that this is happening, okay, and they don't know that you're looking at them, and they don't care. But if they did know that you were looking at them, they might suddenly care. Especially if their mouth was hanging open, they were almost drooling, they were like... So we're actually naturally contemplative, but also restrained at times in terms of being naturally what we are. What we are, meaning uninhibited. In the natural contemplativeness at times, the inhibition falls away. It's no big deal in a way because you're not like on stage in front of everybody. You're just kind of there and quiet and eyes closed and everybody else is too. And, get a sense that this inhibition, this inhibitedness, dissipates. A little, a lot, all the way. So we're here to allow a manifestation through the practice of exactly what Albert is referring to in his quote. In order for that release from that optical delusion to occur, there needs to be the action, you might say, the cause for the release of that delusion. And what is the cause? It's wisdom. What is wisdom? It's the interest, capacity, willingness, you might say, courage sometimes, equanimity, to actually face what's going on here and in a certain sense not flinch. Remember when I was a kid, we used to play a game sometimes, you know, different kinds of games, and somebody would see you and you didn't quite, you flinched. So and then the name of the game was not to flinch, see if you could actually be there. And usually it was kind of willful, you know, to not flinch. Okay, this is different than that. This isn't willful. It's more a willingness to not dodge, to not avoid, if possible, at least for some moments. Because what's sitting here right now is a stream of consciousness. You want to describe a human being? A human being is a stream of consciousness. A That's what's here, a stream of consciousness. This body-mind process is a stream of consciousness. In the slipstream of that consciousness, conditions, which are called the conditions of samsara, or perpetual, habitual wandering, can arise. You don't have to necessarily say, well, why are they arising? It's like people trying to understand intellectually, why is there suffering? That's not going to untie suffering in most cases. Into the slipstream of consciousness, so-called issues or problems can arise. Also in that slipstream of consciousness are all the possibilities. All the possibilities for the human. Complete and total unalloyed freedom, and everything that appears to be its opposite. Very important words. What appears to be its opposite. So, as I said earlier, in different words, the possibility of just doing each thing just for the sake of that thing itself. Each activity just for the sake of that activity. As if there's nothing more. This is one aspect of what's called skillful, correct action, or Buddhist teachings, right action. How to live correctly. Just because you have appeared into this world, into this body-mind process, doesn't necessarily mean that you automatically, spontaneously know how to live correctly. Sometimes the way that we actually learn how to live correctly is through living incorrectly and experiencing the consequences of that. And we get shored up by those consequences, and we discover what not to do. We discover the power of acting in this world when we're not paying attention. And I just mean simple attentiveness that leads to stubbing the toe, metaphorically, literally. Not seeing that a certain action that we're engaged in may have a consequence or an effect quite close to the cause, or much later down the so-called road. Wow, look at that. One sees the ripening, call it the karma, if you will, of things that one did. It's all in the slipstream of consciousness. So the possibility is, and this is what opens the path, yeah, opens the path of liberation, opens the path of clear seeing, opens the path of insight, is to actually have the care, call it the affection, the interest, to allow each thing to be done as if it's the most important thing in the world. Because if you contemplate this, the most important thing you could be doing is what you're actually doing. Because there isn't anything else that you're actually doing except what you're actually doing. And that can change in the next second. But get inside that for a moment. The most important thing you could be doing is what you're actually doing. Now, does that mean if you're doing something really unskillful, and you even know it, that that's the most important thing you could be doing? Guess what? Yes. Someone in a man-woman-made prison tonight, I know someone actually in maximum security prison over here in Tampa, has the same possibility of manifesting true nature, realizing true nature as us sitting here. Regardless of the food, regardless of the conditions around. Why? Because the true nature of what we are, number one, is not a thing like most so-called things. And it's always here. It's not limited by conditions. And yet, you could call it the condition of correct living, yeah? Correct action does in fact open possibilities that otherwise might not be open. And by the way, I might add that that so-called person in that so-called maximum security prison He's actually doing this work here that we're doing. That's what he's spending most of his time doing. So we have a foundation for the path. I just described one part of it. Okay, there are other parts of it. It's really common sense. Take care of your outer actions. Take care of how you live in this world with others and the planet. Take care of it. Let it take care of you. Don't steal. Don't kill. Don't lie. Be careful and mindful of sexuality. Don't harm with it. And don't intoxicate your mind. It's already intoxicated. It doesn't need any more. The job here is to intoxicate it. Okay, I mean, consider this. We've been sitting for a few hours. Look at how much stuff has already come up. Just look at what's arisen through this body-mind process. One can be sitting there even after a lovely session of Steve Bean-led yoga, feeling quite happy in the corpse pose, if you did this afternoon. If you didn't, you missed the most important... No, never mind. It's sitting there, lying there, feeling wonderful, come in the hall, 10 minutes later, it's all tight again. Who did that? If it's not 10 minutes, 15. If it's not 15, it could be 20. But it's going to tighten up again. Why? Because the nature of this is like an accordion. People get a delusion going that awakening means to just go like this, like it's a big giant inhale that never stops. No, it's going like this. This is its nature. It expands, it contracts. Watch it. Awakening isn't like that stops. Part of awakening is there's release from preoccupation and judgment and fighting with and struggling with and preferring this part over that part. Oh, I like the expansion. I don't like the contraction. Let me have the expansion. Let me tell you something about the expansion. There are points where the expansion gets so expanded you're dying for a contraction. It gets so like gigantic that people get freaked out and they just want to like feel the ground again. Because everything's just like so open. I mean, this is just like particles. There's literally more space between the molecules that make up this thing than there are molecules. That's a scientific fact. So as that actually opens up, this thing is like, whew, feels out of control. To who? To the one who's trying to be in control. And then fear arises. That'll close it down. Put the brakes on. As we have a sense, and most of us do, foundationally, of what it means to live in sila. Sila is the Buddhist Pali word for ethical life, you know, outer discipline. Then we can actually focus. We can actually look into the moment. We can have some discipline about our samadhi or our concentration. That's the second part of the path. Get a sense of what mindfulness is, what it means to do one thing at a time. You know, it was so interesting, years ago there was this whole thing about multitasking. Latest research says there is no such thing. We were lying. We had it wrong. All there is like quick movement from one thing to other. There is no multitasking. It's a delusion. Okay, watch it flip around the other way. Another 10 years will go by. It's like coffee and wine. Once the wine wasn't any good, now it's okay, but this much, don't too much now. Coffee, no good, now it's good. It keeps moving around. Because the perceptions are conditioned that see it. And then with the foundation, yeah, of what's called the outer discipline, yeah, living in a way that makes sense, non-harming, the ahimsa, yeah, of Sanskrit, the ahimsa, non-harming, then the inner discipline, meditation, and out of the meditation comes, right, the panya, the wisdom. Part of the wisdom is the compassion. This isn't a compassion now that one tries to feel. It's a compassion that's spontaneous, that arises amidst suffering, wherever that suffering is. And it's spontaneous. No one makes it happen. No one tries to be compassionate. That's what Albert, I feel, is pointing to in his quote, that possibility. So we see there's an infinite variety of experiences that happen in the course of a year, let's say, of so-called measured time. All experiences are appearances. Now notice this. When there is a dream at night, whether there is some lucidity, that means mindfulness of the dream while the dream is happening, or not, once the waking state arises, one would often say, not only is that a dream, but that was an appearance. Okay, so these words are synonymous right now, appearance and dream. The waking states are also just appearances. The true condition of all appearances and all so-called existence is emptiness. Now let's understand this, because this can be confusing to the mind. The reason why it's confusing to the mind is because emptiness is actually the nature of the mind, just as it is the nature of the body. And the human being, when under the influence, the intoxication of delusion, does not see the empty nature of this body-mind process, but instead views this as solid. More than just that, views this as mine, what I am, who I am, exclusively. That's the prison. The true condition of all appearances and all existence is emptiness. All experiences, existences, appearances are empty of substantiality. They are empty of independent abiding, which means everything is interdependent with everything else, which means there is no separation. Even the idea that there's separation, even the feeling of being separate, even the feeling of being alone, is completely interdependent with everything else. So, intrinsic reality is emptiness. One of the words that's used for this in the traditions is shunyata. Shunyata is translated as emptiness. Now, very important, emptiness is not a thing like an object of knowledge or an object of the intellect. If there's an image that arises in the mind or some thoughts that arise in the mind, that's an object of intellect. You could call it an object of knowledge. It's a thing. Emptiness is not a thing. For this reason, emptiness cannot be conceived. You could think about what emptiness is, but it's actually not what it is. For example, just try this. In this room right now, there might be a sense of oxygen. You can't see it, but you can feel it. And if all of a sudden all the oxygen was sucked out of this room real fast, and we're all sitting here just looking at one another, things would change. We would really see impermanence really fast. Okay, it's a little morbid in a way, but... Now, emptiness, okay, is not oxygen, although oxygen is empty. Empty of what? Empty of solidity. Empty of permanence. Yeah. It's transitory. It's rising and passing. Emptiness is incomprehensible to the intellect. But it's actually what the intellect truly is. The intellect is empty. What does this mean? Emptiness is boundless openness. Openness without any boundary. All things, all appearances, all experiences, all existence is empty of solidity, which means it's impermanent. Now you can put your hand right through the air. Okay? Put right through. no solidity. It's not possessible. No one owns it. You could say it's your oxygen. This is a very interesting one, because when the air's out here, we say it's not mine. When the air is in here, now it's mine. Where does the breath become your breath? When it touches your nose? When it's down in here? It's completely made up. It's a parameter or construction that the mind makes up. What is mine and what is not mine? Everything, yeah, we know this now. Science has got it. Mystics knew it for thousands of years. Science awoke into it some decades ago. It's particles, it's waves, it's particle waves. It's moving, it's changing, there's no solidity. This is emptiness. Empty of solidity. Empty of permanence. Empty of lasting existence. Also, too, awareness is not a thing like an object of knowledge or an object of the intellect. Notice this. Because actually awareness is empty. Awareness is emptiness. It's immediate. Notice that awareness is completely unlocatable. Although you could say, seems to be over here, but you can't put your finger on it. It's proving its emptiness right now. Awareness is empty of form, and yet it's the space within which all form appears. If you claim that awareness of your as your own, now you separate that awareness from the so-called forms that the awareness sees. And all that's happened there is a thought has arisen, it's my awareness. You can't prove it, and yet it's sometimes believed in. This is my awareness. I am aware. Awareness is empty. We see this also at night when we fall into deep sleep. What happened to awareness? And it's a delight, isn't it? To pass out. To be unaware. So what's important is that it's not just awareness that's empty of solidity and lasting, abiding, independent existence, but all forms are too. All forms, thoughts, feelings, sensations, perceptions, vision, sight, hearing, smell, taste, the whole kit and caboodle, just like awareness, is empty of solidity, yeah. It's empty of possessibility, it's empty of abiding existence that's independent. So now, in that appreciation of emptiness, all manifestation has its own place. If something's already here, right, what's the point in fighting with it? This doesn't mean we don't get out of the way of the car, like people sometimes misunderstand this, and they say, well, why don't you just walk out in front of the car, Paul? And the answer to the question is, I don't want to. That doesn't make any sense. Emptiness is not nihilism. It's emptiness that allows a true appreciation for the manifestation of all forms. Now, all forms are not just empty of solidity and lasting existence or abiding independence, but all forms are open as themselves upon arising. All forms are what they are already upon arising. They're not becoming what they are. They already are what they are. This is true regardless of your particular conditioned preferences and what they may say, because those preferences themselves are also free and open and spontaneously already themselves upon arising. So what I mean now is that emptiness also is openness. And we have a misunderstanding sometimes here that openness is just expansion. Openness is things as they are. Things as they are. Open, empty, spontaneously, already free as themselves. Not going to become free, it already is. Whatever it is. So what's going on here that we see, as let's just take the example of this body-mind process, is the manifestation of relativity. Okay, this is relativity manifesting. This is the manifestation of cause and effect right here. Okay, this is the manifestation of karma right here. So let's take a few examples of cause and effect. Multiplicity, countless number of causes came together for that meal that we just ate to occur. You put plants in the ground, you put seeds in the ground as a cause for an effect. You get plants, you get fruits. This cushion I'm sitting on, the chair Janet's sitting on, multiple causations came together for this effect. Everything that we see, everything that we experience through our senses, is organized by this law. It was so important that the Buddha called the understanding of cause and effect, he titled it the light of the world. And what he meant was, it's the light of the relative world. It's how you understand the way this relative world works. And that's a set of conditions, or you could call it causes and effects, that we can actually live in harmony with. And it's totally, totally practical, and it makes total, total sense. And to not do it would simply be ignorant. Joy, happiness, peace, states of experience that you could call fulfilling, pleasant, comfortable, have effects. If you sit and observe the body-mind process and you find that there's things arising that just feel unpleasant and you have no idea why they're there, you felt really fine and then they're just there. If you try to track down, what are the causes for this? What are the causes for this condition right now, this effect that's happening? You can never get it. You might even just get a few things that seem to line up there. It would be a wild goose chase. But consider this, that this form here came together through, the combined causes. You had to have a mother and a father. So they each put in. Here we go. That's just a simple view. These five senses. As soon as these five senses arise, there is the possibility, you might say, the effect of contact. The only way we have the sense that there's a so-called outer world is through our sense doors. So as soon as you have the arising of the five senses, you're going to have contact. As soon as you have contact, you're going to have feeling. Now this is where it gets really interesting. Because as soon as you have feeling, okay, we're now at a very powerful pivot point. In the deluded mind, the feelings, as I talked about earlier, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, move habitually into liking, disliking, craving, aversion. Through clear seeing, the feelings don't move into that next effect called craving, aversion, liking, disliking, struggling, holding on, all that. They move into openness. Because their true nature is already open. So we're a little bit behind the game when we don't see this. We're a little bit short of the truth of what's really happening. We're a little slow in the uptake. openness. The feeling just opens, and then the next feeling opens. We're just sticking with the feeling right now. The feeling just opens, and it 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 opens. It manifests. It's empty. It doesn't last. It's not solid. And guess what? It ain't yours. This openness that is the true nature of all forms is actually another word for the unborn. This openness that doesn't die, in the Buddhist teachings, is called the deathless. It is our true nature. Our true nature is not a thing. It's not a perception, it's not a feeling, it's not a thought. It's not a body-mind process. This all comes and goes. The true nature of what we are is unborn, which is another way of saying it doesn't die, because what is born must die. Now notice how these words go into nowhere. There's no place out there that the word unborn goes. Whereas if I say the word lamp, it goes there, maybe. Wall, ceiling. The word unborn goes nowhere. The word deathless goes nowhere. The word unconditioned goes nowhere. Our true nature is open, expansive, unself-centered, uninhibited, natural being. And this natural being, uninhibited, unself-centered, is actually happening in and through all forms of experience. However, it's hidden until it's revealed. So why is it then that so many beings apparently are not experiencing this? And maybe you would insert yourself in there. I don't experience that. I don't experience that all forms are empty, all forms are naturally open, all forms are naturally free as themselves. I don't experience that. I experience something else. You, or I might say. Okay. So here it is. If we do not acknowledge through direct realization, not through intellectualization, but through direct realization, through direct observation, the incessant condition of change in all places and in all ways and in all times, then we are prone to live in dreamlike states of infatuation with what the mind likes and wants, as well as, of course, the opposites of what it likes and wants, which is what it doesn't want and doesn't like. We then end up living an entranced existence with a diminished appreciation for surprise, wonder, and the mystery of life. It's not usually so diminished, because when the party comes along or the surprise comes along, we're ready to pop a bit into that unself-conscious being that's not concerned with how loud he laughs or how goofy his face looks. Right? It's just for a few moments there, the party says, yes, you can be what you already are. But this samsara that I just described, this condition of not seeing the incessant condition of change, the delusion of not seeing the incessant condition of change, goes round and round and round, generating fears of death, illness, old age, loneliness, painful questions that the mind can't answer, problems with reality, a tangle of anxieties, hopes, fears, attachments, and fixations. Ongoing complications, because reality, that means change and impermanence, change and transitoriness, change and ephemeralness, has been misperceived as an enemy rather than what it truly is, which is a friend. Want to get clear about a condition in the relativity of things? Get clear about impermanence. Now, here could be one of those lines that summarizes the whole talk. Am I setting up a condition? See how it sounds. Buddha was very clear, don't take other people's experience as the truth. Don't take hearsay, don't take intellectualization. See for yourself. True security is not what we can predict and calculate with our minds, but rather it is the openness to the mysterious certainty of change. This is where true aliveness lives and where realization takes place. The full-on appreciation for not knowing what will happen, yet knowing and seeing things are constantly changing. The reality of things arising and passing is happening all the time. Nothing that appears does not disappear. This relative truth is absolutely certain. When there is an opening to this condition, and it's a condition, change is a condition. When there's an opening to this condition, the mind naturally lets go. It releases clinging, grasping, holding, can fall away a little or a lot. The real point here in terms of the liberation of view, this whole practice pivots around the liberation of view, not just the liberation of feeling, the liberation of thinking, the liberation of action. We're talking about the liberation of view. Vipassana insight. And that is the perception of solidity gets uprooted. The perception that forms are solid and lasting and undesirable and belong to me and don't belong to me, this perception gets uprooted. A little, a lot, all the way. So, practically speaking, this can begin with something as simple and direct as simply the breath. It's feeling the impermanence of the breathing, feeling the non-solidity of the breathing. As that opening, into that condition ripens, matures, instantaneously, in an instant, that means spontaneously, it can be seen there's no one breathing. Breath is breathing itself. There's no I, me, or mine that's breathing. It's totally simple. It's immediate. And it's liberating. This condition of change, opening into this condition of change, let's just stay with the breathing, can naturally open into the whole of the body. Into the whole of the mind activities. Into the whole of the sensory experience. Eventually, it becomes crystal clear, all phenomena, everywhere. So-called inside, again, perception, inside, outside, all of it, impermanent. You don't have to just go out on the desert and kind of just see those waves and go, whoa, look at that, it's moving. Heat waves or whatever. The whole dance is a dance. It's all particles. Impermanent. Actually, it seems to me, in my imagination, that one of the attractions to looking into the clear night sky isn't just this brilliance, this mysterious brilliance of these spots of light and the infiniteness that they sit in, but that it's shimmering. It's impermanent. But we often don't go, oh yes, it's impermanent. Don't need to think about impermanence. It doesn't help. It's direct experience of it, seeing it. And then actually the seeing, yeah, when I talk about awareness, the awareness itself is also constantly changing. There's no solidity there. Not only is there no I, me, or mine in the awareness, but the awareness itself is completely empty. Resisting this condition of impermanence and change is probably the most common form of suffering and unhappiness in the human realm. Notice how, when a human being is wronged in some cases, by another human being, let's say, or a situation, they feel wronged by nature sometimes, blame God. Notice how long, in some cases, that human being holds on to the wrong. And just contrast that. This isn't always the case, so there's some exceptions here. Notice how quickly certain animals will let go when they're harmed. You can actually harm a dog, and then you can turn around and be nice, and it'll just, sometimes it'll shift. Not always. Sometimes it'll do something else, but sometimes it'll just shift and it'll just open, and it'll be happy with you. We have an amazing way of complicating an already apparently complicated situation with our strategies and our methods, and even our therapies sometimes become very complicated in terms of getting things kind of sorted out, positioned. So much of it often is predicated on trying to maintain at least some semblance of control, and maybe even a better sort of spot of control. Meanwhile, we could be a little or a lot ignoring the fundamental fact that nothing lasts. So we need to really get clear about this condition of change. You can get clear about a lot of things in the course of a life. You can get clear about how to make money, you know, how to be a father, a mother, how to be a good teacher, you know, how to live in harmony with your food chain, your diet, you know, how to train the body, maybe in terms of its being in shape. You can get a lot of different things kind of sorted out in terms of conditions, in business, and so forth. But what's critical in terms of seeing the nature of what you really are, because if you miss seeing the nature of what you really are while in this form, you have missed the fundamental core birthright of a human. And that's okay. It's fine. And that sometimes turns, for some human beings, spontaneously into earnestness and that sanvega, that spiritual urgency, which is not a tension. It's not like this. It's like really, really interested in potentially the most interesting thing, potentially, which is the possibility of unalloyed freedom, here and now, not later in some other place. There is no later and some other place. There's just this, and this, and this, and this. The true view, the right view, as the Buddha called it, the correct view, is one without a second. What does that mean? It means that life is one indivisible wholeness, completeness, and that this wholeness, this completeness, is the ground of being, non-dual, complete, empty of solidity, yet inclusive of all forms. This is what the Heart Sutra is actually pointing to when they say form is emptiness, emptiness is form. That whole teaching, uncompromisingly, goes right at this. The clear, right, true view. One without a second. The spellbinding action of ignorance causes humans to use awareness to reinforce the sense of separateness and alienation. Through fixating themselves as specific states, feelings, thoughts, and inserting or believing in a fictive I that is aware. In this condition, what's arising within the body-mind complex is seen as oneself exclusively. Objects of perception that seem to arise outside of the body-mind, like sounds, objects of sight, and the activities in the world around, and of course other people, are viewed as not-self. These two views are so commonly held and lived out, often without question, that even now it might seem like what's being spoken here is simple mental gymnastics to hear these words and engage in this inquiry. What is happening when there is apparent duality or separation is that awareness is being used to reinforce delusion and ignorance. Awareness is being used not to know the truth rather than to know it. The key feature of this, of course, is not seeing things as they really are, not seeing reality, not seeing it clearly, and therefore misperceiving what is actually occurring, misperceiving it as that which is occurring is me, that which is occurring is mine. The idea that what is happening is mine or is happening to me flies straight away in the face of the fact of impermanence. It also flies straight in the face of the fact that with inquiry, investigation, with practice, the I cannot be found. As the I cannot be found, what naturally happens is there is a falling away of the tendency to keep recreating it as an idea, as a fiction, as a belief, as a feeling, as a perception. If you can't find it, if it can't be found, doesn't that say something? So in a way, the practice actually, instead of going towards anything, it's really not going towards anything. There's no future out there, just as there's no past back there. All there is what's arising, which includes thoughts about what might happen and memories of what did happen. It arises now. The practice opens up into what's called an inversion, where the realization of being, as contrasted to things becoming, the realization of things as they are, simply appears. And it's like, holy smokes, this is the way it always has been. So simple. I've been looking for myself by leaving myself. I've been looking for the truth somewhere else. You can see why contemplation really can make a difference. The cause and effect that I really want to emphasize is that meditation is a cause, and the effect of that meditation is the ripening of clear view, correct view, liberating insight. It is really quite less likely that without contemplation, without inquiry, without investigation, that the human being will even see that they're living in states of delusion. They will actually take the state of delusion, the state of fear, and personalize it. I'm a fearful person. I'm an anxious person. I'm a shy person. I'm an aggressive person. Well, they usually say it different than that, don't they? I'm a greedy person. No, you're not. You're not even a person. Never mind, are you greedy? These forces arise spontaneously. No one owns them. The good news about seeing emptiness clearly is that it uproots the fixation upon what are called the most difficult poisons. That's what the Buddha called them. The poisons, greed, hatred, and delusion. And also it's a byproduct of the release from the identification with those forces. Those forces, when they arise, they fall out because they're empty. There's nothing solid there. There's no ownership. So the misperceiving of reality. Flies straight in the face of the fact of impermanence. I misperceive reality, grasp at this as mine, knowing even intellectually without any contemplation that this will stop, this will dissolve, this is dissolving. It's not a morbid idea, it's the fact, this is dissolving. You don't have to wait until your hair starts to fall out. In my case, I was convinced that was the worst thing that could ever start to happen. What a morbid, crazy idea. For some people, it you know, they don't let the gray happen, or don't let this happen, don't let that happen. You know, let's stay young and pretty. No wonder we want to go to the movies, young and pretty. And we're indoctrinated. And so sometimes the view comes, all of that's wrong. Let me just close my eyes to it. I'll avoid it. I'll go into my cave. And you go into your cave. You go into your solitude. You go into your quietness. And you find those same forces that you saw in the world around you in your mind. Holy smokes, I can't escape. What? Conditionality. Guess what? You don't have to escape conditionality. See conditionality for what it is. It will untie itself. That's the magic. That's the liberation. That's the power of insight. So instead of trying to have the mind this way, have the body this way, there's the possibility, even just for an instant, that the mind-body is released unto itself, to be itself, allowed to be as it is, so that it can unfold freely as it is. And then, as the Diamond Sutra states so clearly, very, very apt teaching. Awareness is abiding nowhere in particular, yet seemingly present everywhere. Notice this. Awareness abiding nowhere in particular, yet seemingly everywhere. The inseparability of direct perception, this means undiluted perception, clear perception, and emptiness. The inseparability of awareness and love. Where does compassion, where does love come from? It comes straight out of seeing things clearly. How life is experienced is totally influenced by the colorations of perception. What this practice is about, what all spiritual practice really is about, is seeing those colorations, seeing those particularizations of how perception has been distorted and colored, and seeing how those are empty, seeing how those unfold themselves, seeing how those are impermanent. And as that happens, spontaneously, clarity arises. There's no one who's clear. Clarity simply arises. Perception based on ignorance complicates everything. It's like trying to look out through a dirty window. With perception being the looking, and the dirt on the window being the ignorance. Things are clouded. Awakening, this could be another one of the one-liners, awakening is simply the realization of the dreamlike nature of appearances. When I say dreamlike, I mean the impermanent, empty nature of everything that's appearing. Nothing to hold on to, nothing to grasp. Some dreams or appearances or experiences last only seconds. Others last minutes. Others last months or seemingly years. Here's a key. The key in awakening is for the dreamlike appearances not to be taken as the reality for the whole of one's life. because if they are, you missed the fundamental birthright. And if you believe that you're going to come again, then you can believe you're going to get another shot. Let me say it again. The key in awakening is for the dreamlike appearances of not just the dream state at night, but the waking states. The waking states. This is the waking state, the relative cause and effect driven waking states. Not be taken as the lasting reality for the whole of life. So then again, very clear teachings, simple line, four words. One ground, two paths. One single ground of being, which includes true nature, Buddha nature, original nature, and delusion ignorance. There's the path of delusion ignorance, and there's the path of original nature. It's not really a path. It's like Bob Dylan said, no direction home. It's not a path. It's not a direction. But it sure seems like delusion and ignorance has a projectile directional quality to it. Have you noticed? Even as things are untying, like say you're sitting here and things are just unfolding, you can kind of see that things are just unfolding themselves. It seems like this is a direction. This is a progression. This is going somewhere. Tied into that, we have the idea, again, fictive as it is, I am going somewhere. The real shift and opening is to see there's no I to even go anywhere. It's called full stop. If not the full stop, it's at least a significant pause in the action. That means the action of delusion. So, you could call it a path. Yeah? It's really just home. Awakening within and beyond the dream of experiences and appearances. Or the other is the path of delusion and bondage. When there is an awareness of how awakening is a possibility and how it can happen and how it actually happens and that it's happening. The apparent path of delusion and bondage unfolds itself as part of the awakening. This is what it means to say samsara or perpetual wandering, habitualness, is nirvana. So-called delusion is liberation. Why? Because delusion, ignorance itself, is empty, impermanent, open, as itself, spontaneously, free already. It's not going to become that. You're not going to become free when ignorance stops manifesting. There's no one who's ignorant. It's completely without substance. Now notice sometimes the mind will say, ooh, that's not how it feels to me. My ignorance feels solid. It's right up here, it's right over here, and it's knotted. And I'm working on it. Right? So then the attention can't help but go there, right? Because it hurts. It's just like when people cut themselves, the hand automatically goes there without thought. Attention went there first, and then maybe the hand goes. So wherever it hurts, this is why this is so perfectly designed. Wherever it hurts, liberation is revealing itself through whatever's happening. What is this liberation? The liberation of impermanence, the liberation of non-solidity. Oh, but Paul, people say over and over to me, it doesn't feel good. I want it to feel like that, like that. I thought it was going to be blissful and joyful and tingly and warm and fuzzy and bath-like. Nice fantasy. They asked the shaman once, why are you not reactive to the ice on your body? The man lived in the ice. He said, because it's real. Because it's real. So it seems like there's only two ways that human beings live. They live in the light of reality, they live as the light of reality, or they live in what appears to be its opposite, which is the darkness, the ignorance, the delusion. There's either the resonance or what appears to be the lack of resonance. The recognition or what appears to be the lack of recognition. So in a very real sense, the statement, life is a dream, is the truth. Experiences are appearances. Appearances come and go. When true nature shines forth, then the dream appearance of experience, very key, can be fully appreciated finally, with all its colors and flavors, with all its nuances, its ups and downs, its ins and outs. Its beginnings, its ends. The whole movie, the appearance, the experience, is a movie. Prior to this clear arising of what we really are, is the game of struggle, negotiation, preference, and search for imagined or hoped for outcomes. And this can predominate the stage of life. So just like in the movie, and the appreciation of the movie, we see the stage of life as the mind has set it up. We even may see, in some cases it goes straight into the family of origin material. One sees why these constructions of mind are happening now, where they were learned. One sees clearly how they were picked up, how they were constellated. It comes clear. The characters, the producer, and finally the director, him or herself, are seen clearly, and then, and only then, an opening beyond can occur. And as this opening occurs, it carries with it the realization that everything is already free as itself, always. Upon arising, everything is already free as itself. Pop. It's like the bubble. You see the bubble. It seems contained. It seems as if it's holding the air. Yeah, it's floating on the stream. And then it seems to liberate itself into what? Non-bubbleness by popping. It's already free as itself, as the bubble. It's already free. What I am saying now about the nature of instantaneous freedom, the open, freely given, freely manifesting, spontaneous truth, is not a belief, it's not an idea, it's not a thought. It's the direct living truth, it's the direct living Dharma. For some human beings, it appears and disappears. It pops clear and then it disappears. It's as if nibbana goes pop and samsara goes no you don't. Because there's still this view in the mind that certain things are it and certain things are not it. It's like the view of true openness, yeah, or oneness, clouded by the idea that you can become whole or one, or that there can be an expansion of oneness. There's no expansion of oneness, right? There's no expansion of wholeness, completeness. Just like there's no way to take the word the deathless or unborn and point it to something that you can find, like a carpet or a light or a ceiling or a person, so to speak, a body. There's only one thing that clouds the true view, and that is the action of ignorance, manifesting as delusion, claiming what is happening as mine, as me, viewing things as permanent, lasting, solid, viewing certain experiences as desirable and certain other experiences as undesirable. This is what clouds the view. In true nature, appearances, experiences, keep appearing. However, they're no longer something to grasp or avoid. The true nature doesn't grasp or avoid. In true nature, appearances, experiences, no longer exclusively, keyword, define who you are. Because all of it is simply a play of consciousness. All of it is simply a manifestation of the Dharma. The stream of consciousness, which is the human, is a play of consciousness. In the entrancement of the dreamlike absorption in particular experiences, holding them, keeping them, trying to have them, repeat them, make them last, not have certain things happen, keep them away, avoid them. One's not only playing the control game, but one's focusing on a particular area in the play of consciousness, such that that play of consciousness becomes work. Isn't it fascinating that we human beings have this distinction until we don't, that there's work and there's play? And those who are lucky enough find that line getting a little fuzzy, and so the work becomes a little bit playful, and maybe a little more playful, and then there may be a moment where it just falls apart. And it's not work or play. Those words don't apply. It's just a flow. It's a stream. This is the childlike wonder that all of us touched, at least to some extent, usually interrupted by somebody telling us to get busy and to focus and to remember and to not forget. And this is what you do, and this is what you don't do, and this is your name, and you're a boy, you're a girl. Stop dressing up like a girl, they said to little Tommy. Stop dressing up. Put your sister's clothes back. You're a boy. We can't have this. Eat your peas. One of my greatest liberating experiences before any of this stuff appeared was the joy, the pure, unalloyed joy of taking those lime green peas, which are the worst kind of canned peas possible. Not the dark green, I'm talking about the sick green peas. And the older sister, yes, there she was across the table, the large round table. There she was with her big mouth flapping the words out over and over. No one was doing anything. No one was doing anything. She was just flapping her jowls. And so the green pea sat on the end of my thumb, and I lined it up. And there might have been a quiet, yes, a quiet prayer. but I don't remember for sure. Anyways, the pea suddenly released and was propelled through space. And sometimes even without a clear prayer that precedes the action, the result follows. Cause and effect. Wang, it went straight in. I think maybe it hit her uvula in the back. Fortunately for me, she didn't end up choking. But the speech spontaneously went to the other side of the law of causation, which was, it dissolved. It was with great risk that this action was performed. In the play of consciousness, true nature is the one thing that never comes and goes. It's hidden in the stream. What Einstein's pointing to, what this whole thing here is about, is the possibility of it popping out of the stream and saying, yes, here you are. Here you are. Stop looking. I am what's looking already. It's hidden in the stream. It's hidden in change. The unconditioned isn't something way out there beyond relativity. What's actually sitting here isn't just the impermanent flow of the stream of consciousness. What's sitting here is the true nature of eternity. It's impossible to describe. It's utterly and totally impossible. So let me try. There is only, always, that which is already everything. We are all Buddhas with amnesia, living to remember ourselves. Dzogchen, 12th century Zen master, said it this way: the true being is not anyone in particular, but like the limitless deep blue sky, it is everywhere and everyone in the world. The impermanence, poetically enunciated as a star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, a flickering lamp, a phantom, a dream. So is all conditioned existence to be seen when conditioned existence impermanence is seen this way. True nature arises like a flower that opens into the sun. It's already free as itself. So we could just sit for a minute or two together.